Today's episode of Current Geek brought to you by Audible.com. At audiblepodcast.com/currentgeek, you can get a free audiobook right now. It's a huge selection, so pick carefully. That's audiblepodcast.com/currentgeek. And by Casper. At Casper.com, an online retailer of premium mattresses for a fraction of the price, because everybody, that means you, deserves a great night's sleep. Get $50 off any mattress purchase by visiting Casper.com/currentgeek and enter the promo code Current Geek.
I have
Current Geek!
Current Geek!
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Current Geek. This is Current Geek, the weekly proceedings of the meetings of the Frog Pants All-Stars. There you go. Geeks of the world and you, to keep you current on all things that matter most. I'm Scott Johnson. He's Tom Merritt.
Hey, I'm Tom. But he stole my line.
I do it every week, though. I take it every week, like
once
candy
again,
from a baby.
Scott Johnson. Hey, it's great to be here. Is this 2 weeks in a row now?
Yeah, 2 weeks in a row. Can you believe it? Nobody's had a trip or some filming to do or a family thing come up or a wedding.
We should get one of those signs up that says, you know, Current Geek has been operating 2 weeks without an accident.
Without a horrible accident. Well, let's see if we can change that tonight with our fabulous guests. Joining us tonight, returning both of them. Let's start with Mr. Jonathan Strickland. He's the How Things Works man.
How stuff works, Scott.
I did it
how
again.
How stuff works.
I did it again, but you'll never know if I did it on purpose or by accident.
Well, at least you're consistent.
Yeah, at least I do it every time we're together. Jonathan, welcome back, man. It's good to have you here.
It's great to be here, Scott. Looking forward to it. I am very much entrenched in the geek world.
Good.
I can't wait to let my geek love pour out.
Oh, good. Yeah. I'm glad. I thought you were going to say hang out, and then we were going to have to hang up on you. It's fine. also joining us, returning guest and co-host of a couple of rad podcasts, specifically ITN, Into the Nexus, all about Heroes of the Storm, a number one ranked player in Heroes of the Storm, something I'm very jealous of, and a nice guy all around. You know him as Kyle Ferguson, and he's right here. Hi, Kyle.
Oh, what a stellar introduction. Thank you for having me.
Something like that. It's good to have you back, man.
You're number one.
You are number one. And so let me ask you a question about that real quick before we move on. When you hit rank number one in that game, are you just tempted to just do nothing but quick matches from here on out because you don't want to lose the rank, right, until they do a wipe or a new season or whatever?
Right. It is scary to keep going. I mean, I have fallen down and then had to climb my way back up. But honestly, I love Heroes League and the drafting system. And I can't make myself play quick match anymore. And I love the game. So I just got to keep going.
All right. Well, you've impressed me, Tom, and your mother. Keep it up. Don't go changing.
That's good.
All right, good. We have some headlines, and they begin with this.
Herbert Hoover, Secretary of Commerce in 1922, finds infant radio facilitates news gathering, as do many others in high public office.
Wonderful. What's the forecast? What does it look like out there?
Currentgeek.reddit.com is what it looks like, Scott. That's where we see the things you want us to talk about on Current Geek. And if you don't get in there and vote, we're liable to talk about anything.
Yeah.
So do it. Caffeine69 did it. He brought us the sad news, actually, that game commentator John Bain, a.k.a. the Cynical Brit, a.k.a. Total Biscuit, announced on Twitter that his fight with cancer is not over and has sadly moved to his liver. It's inoperable, and he says average life expectancy for this kind of cancer is 2 to 3 years. However, he writes, I intend to beat it for as long as possible. Going to need some time to process all of this. I don't really feel anything right now.
Yeah, he's young yet, and he has a very optimistic view of things. He said in that same statement that, a lot can happen in the next few years in terms of research and breakthroughs, and he intends to be a young, strong prime candidate for anything that may come that direction. But despite all of that, very sad news. We have similar origins and beginnings. We were all sort of involved in the early Warcraft coverage space, 2006, 2007, when things were really exploding, and we had some back and forth back then with John, and I am super, super sad to hear about this. And it's maybe, I don't know, it's weird. We're just now getting to that place in internet content creation history where the people we listen to and watch and pay attention to and see their videos and things, we're just starting to get to a place where some of them are getting older. This, in his case, this stupid cancer has cropped up in his life. You're starting to have those moments, whereas that used to be the the place of old media and TV stars and people that, you know, were popular in the 80s and 90s. To me, it's just a sign of the times that we've kind of progressed this far and that we've got a whole new layer of people that we admire and that we follow and that we respect. And I'm just sad to hear about this.
There's a ton to admire about the guy. I mean, not only has he sort of led the forefront in dealing with problems in the industry like pre-orders, but the amount of money and time that he has sunk into StarCraft as an esports is just unprecedented. And that he's had to continue to battle these sort of things. It's just awful.
Yeah, it sucks.
Yeah. He is really a great voice in game commentary and explaining things ranging from game design to marketing to various things that bug all gamers, things like the idea of releasing broken games and then gradually patching them up over time. These are the sort of things that he's given really thoughtful analysis to in the past. And I urge anyone who is not familiar with his work to seek out the videos he's done because they're very thoughtful. I actually got a chance to listen to him live at Dragon Con. He was a guest at Dragon Con. And it was the first time I didn't even get a chance to meet him, which really hurts. I mean, I was just so busy, but his presentation in front of a live crowd and his thoughtfulness in the way he handles questions, really was striking. It's something that I admired very much.
Yeah. So we'll hopefully, I don't know. He seems like the type that's not going to take the sitting down. So hopefully.
Well, like you said, he says in here that the 2 to 3 year life expectancy includes a lot of people who get this when they're very old and less able to fight it off. Mm-hmm. He plans to beat those odds by quite a bit. And I like the fact that he says, hopefully I can beat it off long enough for them to cure it, which is, again, like, exactly the attitude you need to have in his situation. It's fantastic.
Completely agree.
Caffeine 69 also pointed us to a much less sad note about how Netflix uses piracy to succeed rather than blindly trying to suppress it. Netflix uses local piracy statistics, apparently, to determine what content it should offer in a region, as well as set the local price. Ted Sarandos says the real great news is that in the piracy capitals of the world, Netflix is winning. We're pushing down piracy in those markets by getting success. As for people who use VPN to get around Netflix region restrictions, Sarandos says the best way to make the VPN issue a complete non-issue is through global licensing that we're continuing to pursue with our partners.
Hmm. Yeah, wouldn't it be nice? I mean, when's the day come when, I remember, like, video game consoles are famous for this. Actually, Heroes of the Storm is famous for this. If we want to play with our European friends, we can't because it's region locked. So why do we live, Tom, give us a refresher on why we even live in a time where we can't just all have the same exact damn library and everyone's looking at Breaking Bad at the exact same damn time.
Jeez, man, you need like Jonathan Strickland to research for 3 weeks to give you an answer to that.
I could give you a couple of
things. All right, give us the TLDR. What do you got?
Well, I mean, the TLDR, one is money, just the idea that being able to leverage exactly when you want things to go on sale, where you want them to go on sale. Another thing is just technology, things like display frame rates. I mean, in the old movie days, you're talking about two primary different standards that you produce things for. So effectively, you had to produce two separate types of hard media in order to get them off to the various regions. But largely, I would say it's a control thing. It's where studios want to be able to maximize the profit potential of their work. And they have worked very hard to figure out, you know, what kind of rollout is going to have that kind of impact. I mean, you're starting to see that now with movie releases too, where, you know, we used to be really spoiled here in the United States, where we would get everything first, at least everything that was produced in the U.S. That's not the case anymore.
No. Not even Star Wars, man. We can't even count on Star Wars premiering in the States.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's shot in, you know, primarily in London and then
sure,
in another place.
Sure, but Empire Strikes Back came and happened here, and that was primarily shot in London. I'm just telling you, whatever changed, something definitely had a little sea change. As the world has gotten smaller, that started happening with movies, and the money, if you follow the
money.
You
just didn't know whether it was happening.
Right. Well, I guess so, yeah.
The historical trend behind what Jonathan is giving you the examples of is, hey, nobody can access what everyone else around the world is accessing at the same time. So why not play to the local environment because that makes sense. So, for instance, I want to put out Star Wars on May 5th, 1977, and I look at the calendar and I see that there's really nothing else that can compete with me there. That's great. But then I'm in France, and they've got a whole different system because they're more isolated. It's harder to get to France. They have their own film industry, and I see that, like, this huge filmmaker is putting something out on May 5th, 1977, and I'll get crushed. So I decide, in France, I'll put it out on May 12th when it won't be directly in competition with that title. And no one in France will care because they don't know what's going on in the United States. They can't visit the United States or talk to people in the United States. And that's really what changed. Now everybody can talk to anyone on the planet, potentially, at exactly the same time. So when Patrick Beja goes to see the Star Wars Force Awakens 3 days before the rest of us, we won't want to talk to him.
Well, let Tom, let's be fair. I don't want to talk to him now.
Yeah. Let's lay it out.
You just can't understand his accent.
And I realize this is off story a little bit, but Kyle, I'd like your opinion on the whole, why do we, okay, I get the whole idea that you have to stagger things around the world when it comes to big launches of mainstream entertainment. But when it comes to me and you playing a video game online with a European friend, why do I need to have a different account? Why can't we all just be bridging servers and hanging out together all the time? Some games do, obviously, but there's so many region-locked games, and Blizzard stable of games, which you cover a lot, is completely locked down that way. It's all region-locked.
Right, and you can make excuses for them. One of the ones is region. You want to, you know, play with people you can actually communicate with. But then in America, we play with, if you play late enough at night, or just because they're up late for them, we play with New Zealand and Australia all the time. We're part of their server. Mm-hmm. So it's not like, you know, bridging the ocean is our issue for connectivity. Mm-hmm. And so it just comes down to, is it money? And that's kind of sad.
Yeah. And it's also, well, there's latency.
And it's arguable. I mean, it's bringing it back to this story. Sure. What Netflix is saying is, actually, folks, we'll all make more money if we just play into the new reality. It used to be more about money because the reality said, well, it doesn't really matter if you put things out at the same time because nobody can tell. So you'll make more money if you adjust. Now those conditions are changing.
Mm. No, it's a great system to have because we have Steam, and it's all just about making things more convenient than it could possibly be for you to pirate it.
Well, and I think also with video games, computer games, you also, it's not just the money of how much money can we make in this region at this time, but how much money are we going to have to spend to build out the infrastructure capable of supporting play across vast regions and make sure it's a satisfying experience for everyone involved. I will say, I don't find the language barrier to be that big of a problem. I distinctly recall the best game of Halo 2 I ever played was when me and a buddy went online late in I think it was early in the morning on like a Saturday, and we were put with a group of people who only spoke French. And so we desperately were trying to communicate with one another. And so at one point I hit the little radio button. I said, "Parlez-vous anglais?" And I hear after a second click, "Non. Parlez-vous français?" So I click again and say, "Je ne parle pas français, malheureusement," which just means I don't speak French, unfortunately. And then it went quiet. And then and then after a while, I hit it again and then I said, "Oui, la toilette." Where's the bathroom? And all I hear are all of my teammates laughing. And then one of them hits the radio button and says, "I like it very much." And then we were communicating.
Yeah, finally. The walls are down. Yeah, I know. I guess we, as much as global as we are, I guess there are still lots of issues, and one of them being money and who gets it.
The nicest part of this story is seeing a company that's like, yeah, we have to deal with the fact that there's all these old ways of dealing things, but we're trying not to. Mm-hmm. And we're trying to look at things like piracy and say, what can that help us do to make our product better? Just heartening.
It's fostering an industry that would otherwise be dead. I mean, you look at Netflix, and for those who don't watch anime, you're probably thinking, why is it constantly throwing anime at me? But piracy has just been crippling that industry for years now because people don't want to wait for things to be translated. They download it from Japan, and then they're sick of it by the time it comes out in English.
Yeah, it's a good point.
Well, Sunglow Steve points to an intriguing article in The Atlantic about an unusual star dubbed KIC 8462852. between the constellations of Cygnus and Lyra. Observations from the Kepler Space Telescope detected irregularly shaped aperiodic dips. It's too much to be a planet, and the star is too old for it to be planet formation. So their best estimation is that it could be some disturbance of material, maybe a lot of comets or something, or maybe aliens. Yay. So they're proposing to look for radio waves, just in case.
Okay, I was hoping you were going to talk about the truth here, which is aliens. Yeah, that's cool. I love this kind of stuff, because didn't this, I mean, if we're seeing it, isn't this already done? Whatever it was millions of years ago?
1,400. 1,400.
Is it 1,400? Thanks.
Oh, okay.
It's 1,400 light years away.
Uh-huh.
So this happened, you know, good stretch back, you know, around 600, 700 in our terms. But the cool thing here is that if, in fact, it's alien in origin, what we're seeing is something akin to a Dyson sphere.
Yeah.
That could be one explanation.
Whoa. Yeah. A megastructure.
Probably a Dyson sphere that exploded in a horrible disaster 1,400 years ago.
Which means that they used to be higher up on the Kardashev scale than we were.
Yeah, not so much now, you're thinking.
Yeah.
That's pretty neat. How visual are we getting with this thing? Can we see it, or is this okay?
No.
All right.
We're seeing aperiodic dips. And while I work with a few aperiodic dips, that's not the kind we're talking about.
Right.
We're saying dimming of the light. That's how we're detecting this.
Interesting. Okay. I love this kind of crap. Not crap. I love this sort of science and stuff, but it's always funny to me. I always just feel like, well, ever since, you know what, the show ruined it for me, Tom. That time we talked about the fact that we're probably never going to get anybody's signals with the SETI program because we don't have any way to decrypt their data. Like, it's just going to come over here.
Snowden ruined it for you.
Yeah, and ever since, I guess it was Snowden. And when he said that, I just went, well, shite. Like, what fun is this then? We got this huge array of all these dishes pointing someplace for
here's the thing. They're going to use NRAO's Green Bank Telescope to look for radio waves. And even if they're encrypted, what they're looking for is radio waves that indicate some sort of non-natural phenomenon.
Okay.
So they're saying, look, we see this weird aperiodic dip. Maybe it's just a bunch of disturbed comets. If so, we won't get a bunch of weird radio waves at it. But if we do get a bunch of radio waves, then maybe that's a sign on its own of something, even if we can't decrypt them or understand them.
Okay, fair enough. That's all we need.
We need to do the prudent thing now and declare the sun a national park before we build the Dyson sphere around it and no one gets to enjoy the sun.
Well, we would likely build our Dyson sphere so that it actually also included the Earth's orbit in it. I don't think we would ever be so foolish as to leave. Like, wow, it sure is dark, but man, all my electronics are buzzing.
Yeah, they're on fire. I just feel like the idea of saying, let's go to the Seoul National Park sounds weird to me. So I'm not sure I'm ready.
It's hottest property in our solar system.
That's also in Utah because you have the Jazz. So yeah, you would need Seoul National Park.
We do. Also a very mysterious intergalactic phenomenon we still can't quite explain.
By the way, John, do you think we need to make the clarification for the one astronomer in the audience that's saying, well, there are actually multiple periodic dips, but as a whole, they are considered aperiodic?
Mm. Yes, we probably should be. And I should also point out that when I say Dyson sphere, I'm really talking about megastructures that would surround a star and not necessarily a Dyson sphere, because if it were a Dyson sphere, a true Dyson sphere, we wouldn't see light from the star in the first place.
That's a ring world.
Yeah, you know, you know what this is called? Up and coming podcasters, this little point to the little learning moment. That was all called email damage management.
Email avoidance behavior.
Yeah, yeah. That's exactly what that was.
Hey, Star Fury Zeta sent the bad news. The 2015 World Championship Punkin' Chunkin' will not be held for the second year in a row. The farmer who used to host the events in Delaware pulled out after he and the organizers faced a personal injury lawsuit filed by a volunteer after an ATV accident in 2011. That suit was settled out of court, but the organizers can't get insurance for a new event now.
Oh my gosh. This is a travesty. Listen, if you're going to volunteer for a thing, do they sign waivers? I guess maybe they didn't, and that's maybe the problem. But you should have people sign waivers, and if they're going to volunteer, then it's on them if that ATV falls on them.
I mean, right, but what a disappointment. An ATV accident when he could have been hit by a pumpkin?
Right? Where'd you get injured? The big pumpkin chunking thing. Oh, by a pumpkin? No, an ATV.
Listen, Scott, I know you're a tool of the ATV industrial complex, but you know, if you are negligent in your ATV manufacturer and I sign some waiver, that shouldn't stop me from getting recompense for bodily injury.
I see.
Now, wow. I shouldn't. Whether or not Scott is a tool is beside the point, but pumpkin chunking actually is one of the first podcast topics I had to cover when Discovery purchased How Stuff Works several years ago, because Discovery, I think it was on the Science Channel, they used to broadcast the Pumpkin Chunkin' competition. And so one of the things that very rarely would Discovery tell me that I would need to do a specific topic for my show, Pumpkin Chunkin' was one of those times. And I got to tell you, after about 15 minutes of talking about these devices, you're really thinking like, what, how do we pad out the show?
Listen, my, also just a side note, my favorite Ben and Jerry's flavor is Pumpkin Chunkin', for the record. So there you have it.
And I love the, what, the president of the World Championship Pumpkin Chunkin' Association says, quote unquote, it's a bummer.
Yeah.
that's what you'd expect a guy who's president of the Pumpkin Chunkin' to say.
What a bummer, dude.
It's just the truth.
Is this the one that the Mythbusters went to last year? Is this that thing?
Not last year, because they didn't have it last year.
Oh, they didn't have it last year. Okay. But they've done, didn't they used to do that? Like, sent like Belichick out there before he wasn't on the show anymore?
Well, yeah, because I think Discovery, the way Discovery works is that when they're promoting something, they tend to put as many of their different properties in line. Like Shark Week is a great example.
Yeah.
That was the other one. I had to do two different Tech Stuff episodes about Shark Week. And so that was, you know, it's just one of those things where, they look at the properties they have, which ones are in best in alignment with whatever event they're going to promote. And then they throw everything at it. And, you know, to be fair, those devices, those actual, those pumpkin chunkin, gadgets are pretty impressive.
Oh, yeah. And dangerous. I'm surprised somebody hadn't gotten hurt by one of those. An ATV. I mean, what the crap? Is he just getting sandwiches or something? Like, that's boring. They're one of these giant, like, swinging trebuchets should have picked a dude up and hucked him three counties over. That's a cool accident you want to sue for.
All right. Let's lighten the mood a little with some reviews for Steam's gaming machines that came out this week. Ars Technica liked Steam OS's smooth operation and UI layout, 1,500 game launch library. They didn't as much like it occasionally hanging on certain screens or issues with the on-screen keyboard and mouse. They said performance was a mixed bag. Some games didn't work all that well with Steam Link, which streams it from one machine to another. The controller, while customizable, they said was a little confusing and not as intuitive as the current console controllers. Sean Buckley, on the head of their hand, thinks the controller is awesome. He was writing for Engadget. Said he liked the Alienware Steam machine, thinks it might make a good introduction to PC gaming for newbies. And Steam OS officially launches November 10th.
Yeah, I'm sufficiently jazzed about this, but I think my wind has been turned down slightly during the year. So when they first announced all this stuff, I was like, oh, yeah, dude, we're getting into this now.
When they first announced it, you were like,
yeah.
And now you're like,
there's a little whistle out of the side of my nose or something. But I think the problem is there have been other things happen between then and now that have been either more compelling or functioning great. I would argue, and a little disclaimer here, I do a show on the weekends for NVIDIA, so Shield, just mention you? That. But I really like the Shield streaming. It's really, really good. It's one of the surprising things about the device. I have a lot of problems with that device, but my main good things to say are, one, Netflix looks incredible on that Tegra chip. I don't know why, but it just does. Someone could explain it. But then the game streaming from my Steam library to my television over a standard Wi-Fi connection is pretty flawless. It looks really, really good. So I guess I'm getting other things that do the job already, so I'm just less worried about rushing out and getting one. And then secondly, VR has taken so much of the stage for me in terms of what I'm interested in. It feels like that stuff's leaped over this, and this feels like, well, that's a fun idea, and it's an interesting way to disrupt the console market, and good luck to you, Steam, but I'm really more interested in Vive and in Oculus and in, you know, to some degree, PSVR. So, I don't know. Where are you guys standing on all this? You excited about this thing? Do you think these reviews are fair and balanced? John?
Oh, well, start with the non-gamer guy.
Yeah.
I'm just going to say it. Steam machines from the very get-go have me scratching my head. I mean, I understand the idea of positioning against the console market, but honestly, the PC gaming market has just been crazy over the last several years, largely due to the Steam infrastructure.
Sure.
And I just, anyone who's interested in that, I think, is already interested enough in PCs where they don't need the PC for dummies kind of approach of this console. They are passionate about it. They learn about it. Many of them build their own machines, and this was one of those things where I was trying to figure out who was the market for these devices.
Part of it is, I think some of this, and Kyle, you can jump in on this too. I feel like the market is partially, like, these guys are assuming it's for noobs, you know, PC gamer noobs. I don't actually agree. I think it's for those of us who are big time PC gamer aficionados, and for the increasing part of their library that is controller friendly, that would be a good couch game. Or even third-party games that are coming out on all the platforms, and the PC version is the best or highest fidelity or whatever. It would be really nice if there was a seamless, glitchless way for me to have that experience in front of my TV without having to have, you know, a whole second computer, or worry about managing a console as well, or buying it on two platforms. So I think that they are targeting me and you and others. But Kyle, what's your thinking on this?
Real quickly, Kyle. Sean didn't say he thought Steam was targeting newbies. Sean said that he thought maybe the only person who might like this would be someone who was interested in getting into PC gaming or taking that next step up. I didn't want, if Sean heard this or got passed along, to think we were mischaracterizing what
he said. Oh, yeah, we don't want to.
Okay, go ahead, Kyle.
Good job.
So the keyboard it's a bizarre piece of technology. I have no idea why the Q is in the top corner, why it doesn't just go ABC order through the buttons, but everything works fantastically. Mm-hmm. And for my heroes, my Dota, my shooters, I want this. But there are so many wonderful games right now, mainly indie games, that are so relaxing and turn-based that I just want to get off away from my computer, particularly because I freelance from home and I just don't want to be here anymore.
Right, and if you can just go in there and play a game. I've been playing a game called Downwell, which I guess is based on some book by Lovecraft. I don't know enough Lovecraft to know, but anyway, it's this weird 8-bit looking game where you kind of Mario your way down a well in procedurally generated kind of roguelike situations. Super cool indie game that just came out. Got it on PC, not available anywhere else except, well, it's on a mobile. But if I want to play it on my TV, that's a great way to just zip it over to some streaming device and just play the thing. So I agree with you 100%. And some of those experiences, or bigger experiences like Batman Arkham City, that's actually, or Knight, but that's a bad example because they had PC problems. But let's say something like The Witcher 3. The best version of that game is on PC. Runs at a better frame rate, better textures, better everything. So if you can run that on there already, but you want to just chill with a controller in your hand, which is how I'm playing it anyway, then that's how you want to do it. So I don't think this is just targeting those who might need to be introduced to PC gaming, be they newbies or not, or, you know,
again,
even just drawn away.
Not what Sean was saying.
I know. But
but it was kind of what I was saying. So I appreciate this perspective.
Yeah, I think they do want us to want it. And I kind of do want it. I just need it to work really well. And
I think you're right, Scott. It's just the energy is gone with VR. I mean, I saw, maybe was it 4 years ago, Gabe sitting on a couch playing Dota mm-hmm. with this controller, and that blew my mind.
Yeah.
Playing a MOBA with controller? But now, you know, it took too long to come out, so I feel like it's kind of the last apple on the bench at the grocery store, and you're thinking, well, no, there must be something wrong with it.
A little bit. A little bit.
I think a lot of the game console alternatives suffer from that same thing, that a lot of the ones that have been announced over the last few years took too long to get out from the point where they were announced. And by the time they came out, there was a very lackluster response based upon what the capabilities were. And I'm thinking of everything from, like, the streaming services, for example. A lot of folks were, you know, like Ouya and things like that. By the time it finally got out in front of people, they felt that their initial enthusiasm might have been misplaced.
Well, that, and also you just didn't have the games, you didn't have the quality, you didn't have the things that traditional consoles were going to provide. And so when you looked at especially today, you look at the pricing comparisons, the Steam boxes are priced pretty well, especially that small one, the $50 one. But if you want to get one of, like, the Alienware one, you're going to be paying for a box that's going to cost you right about what a PlayStation 4 or an Xbox One will cost you. So because of that, and I don't know why I would be deterred if I was somebody trying to get my first machine in the house. I would probably still go for a PS4 or an Xbox One over the, over that. So I'm not even sure that market's being served very well. I think it's more for us.
It feels a little bit like if I'm a PC gamer, I've got a setup. I'm not without a setup, right?
Yeah.
And so if I go for a console, it's because I want the games that are available in that ecosystem, mm-hmm. right? Or the games that are designed best for that ecosystem in some cases. And the other side of this is I'm not necessarily a PC gamer and I'm choosing a console and I've already chosen. I've probably already got a PC, a PS4 or an Xbox One if I'm a, if I'm at the upper end, or, you know, willing to spend more on games and jump in early. So they're off cycle for those people, right? Yeah. Xbox One and PS4 came out years ago.
Sure.
If these were coming out at around that same time of the PS4 and the Xbox One, then I think there'd be more of a conversation. But it's kind of like, hey, we're off in bundle land for the consoles now. So this just seems kind of like you say, that last apple on the bench. I think that's a perfect analogy.
It's also a very odd thing for a kid. You'll never see a kid in a store going, Mom, please, 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 can I get the Steam streaming box? Well, what does it do? Well, it lets me stream video games from the computer to there. Well, what do we need to do that? Well, we need a better video card on this side, and our Wi-Fi sucks, so we need a new router. I mean, I guess what I'm saying is there are layers of complexity.
For one of the Alienware Steam. They wouldn't have to get the streaming box.
That's true. That's true.
The Alienware, you're killing all that magic of a console, which is I never have to adjust the settings. It's so disappointing to buy a new game and get in there and go, okay, well, maybe the faces can be medium now, but I really want that fog effect. And you try to eke out that little bit in The Witcher 2, but every time it just crashes.
Yeah, it's a little bit. I guess what I'm saying is there are layers of complexity that consoles generally have figured out over the years how to remove. You know, they're generally known as working out of the box. You just plug them into your TV. That really hasn't changed over the years, and supposedly that's still kind of the experience. And yes, we have more patches and problems with day one releases and things than we didn't used to have with cartridges and whatnot, but it's still an out of the box, go for it, under $300 experience. And these other ones just seem like you're introducing potential complexity, whether you're streaming or you're just like, well, what is this? If this is your first Steam experience, like, what the hell that even look like? Are you just downloading Portal? I guess that's what you're doing. I don't know. I don't even know. It's just a different prospect. I guess what I'm saying is if you go buy a new Nintendo, Tom, you're getting it because the pack-in is a Mario game. You go buy a Steam machine, what are you doing? Like, what
you've got a nice-looking store, it looks like, and you've got all the PC games in the world. But I think I kind of see what you're saying, which is if you don't know what those games are ahead of time,
that's my point.
Kind of don't know what you're getting.
Right, that's my point. It's kind of, I don't want to say that PC gaming is an exclusive club and we're all in the know and everyone else is talking to a speakeasy door and we need the password. It's not that bad, but it's bad enough to at least make it confusing around the holidays when grandma's trying to figure out what Billy wants. That's all.
Yeah. I wonder if this is good enough for now and it will get enough people experimenting and people trying it out and they'll work out the kinks that when the next console cycle comes around, then maybe we'll see a couple of these rise to the top and compete with them. And that's where the true test will be.
Yep.
I wish I had a grandma who messed up and got me Alienware products.
Yeah, right? Oops.
Oh, grandma. Oh. Why'd you get me this incredibly powerful machine?
Darn it.
D. Van Dyckel submitted the call from Wired's Jordan Crucciola for Netflix to bring back Firefly or Amazon or Hulu or somebody. Jordan argues that the cultural sensibilities of today are built for stories like Firefly, citing the Marvel Cinematic Universe, the hero in and over his head mythos that we see Chris Pratt playing in multiple movies. And he's got a very long and well-reasoned argument why it's time now to bring Firefly back.
And I am in the mood to say I'm not saying this. So he may be saying this, and I haven't read the full article. So if he is saying this, I apologize. We can talk about that. But I'm saying it doesn't even need to be Fillion and crew. It can be a whole new story, whole new people. Put it in that universe. Have the sensibilities, the language, the tone, everything you like about it. But just move on to the next generation and go.
Why? They all want to do it.
Oh, all right, well, then never mind. Bring them all back.
Well, well everybody but Wash. Sorry, spoilers. Everybody but Wash is back in.
If Captain Tight Pants is not in the show, I don't want the show, Scott. Also, I mean, Wash, like, they could do something similar to what they did in the comics, spoiler, where Wash appears as sort of a conscience in the minds of a character. So it's not like he's not there, but he can sort of be there literally, I guess, in spirit. There's still people who are busy doing other things. Like Castle is still going on, right? So that's an issue. There's a matter of time. I think we might be at a point where Joss Whedon would be willing to take another stab at this anyway, simply because I'm sure he's disenchanted with his experience of the Marvel Cinematic Universe stuff. I would argue that Firefly actually built the groundwork for things like the Marvel Cinematic Universe and the Guardians of the Galaxy models. And it was just one of those things where it was ahead of its time, but it was what ushered in these other products that seemed to kind of follow in that same general spirit. Also, it doesn't hurt that Joss Whedon was involved in some of them. Mm-hmm. But I think it's not so much that it's time is now. It's more like it ushered in the era we're in. Mm.
Do you think?
And then the other side of it is, hey, you've got people willing to take chances on things in ways that weren't available for Firefly when it was around. So you have the Netflixes and Amazons of the world willing to throw some money at stuff.
Yeah.
And beyond that, you've got the model where you can release an entire season at once. And the biggest issue I had when Firefly was on television with Fox was that, one, they aired them out of order. They did not air the pilot first. They aired it second or third. And they would preempt it for anything, right? Like if there was a T-ball tournament, they'd preempt Firefly. So being able to get all of those shows at once and just, you know, binge on it is exactly the sort of stuff that fan base would love the opportunity to do.
So let's make a prediction. Kyle, does it ever happen? Because it does feel like it should, but will it?
Right. And I agree completely with what John's saying, that it is the time for it. We're totally in that mindset. But is there a time limit on people like Nathan Fillion? I mean, we hear about Ron Perlman constantly trying to push the next Hellboy movie because he's getting a little old and we don't want to see old Hellboy jumping around.
Yeah. Well,
Hell Grandpa.
I wouldn't mind seeing Hell Grandpa. Yeah. That'd be all right. Hell aging adult, not just Hellboy anymore. That's what it would be.
They could partner with the Jackass crew and do the Bad Grandpa Hellboy crossover.
Oh, man.
Hell Seniors.
Oh, there's a comic in there somewhere. But you're right. I agree that the clock is ticking. It's now or never, or it's now and reboot, or it's later in reboot or something.
I think the Serenity has sailed. I think it's too late to go back to that. It would either mean a complete reboot, but, you know, I know everyone has really fond memories of it. All the cast has fond memories of it. They all felt like it was a magical time in their careers where they were really enjoying what they were doing. The fans loved what they were doing. The only people who didn't seem to have any support for them were, unfortunately, the television studio that broadcast their work. But I think at this point, as much as everyone loves the thought of it, the reality is it's probably just never going to happen.
So here's the thing. If Netflix has data that shows people are constantly watching Netflix and rerunning it and watching it again and again on Netflix, then I think that they would have shown interest by now.
Yeah. I mean, it may also be that there are these other properties like Castle that maybe they have shown some interest and we just don't know about yet.
Yeah.
I mean, Netflix brought back Arrested Development. It maybe we will see. I mean, I would love to be wrong about this because I love Firefly and I love that cast and crew. I would love to see it come back. I feel like most of the folks involved have resigned themselves that part of their lives was an awesome chapter that has closed.
Yeah. Did they get along with Baldwin? Does anyone know?
I don't know.
Okay.
Oh, like, you mean
why even?
I only bring it up because if you're going to try to put them all back together, you can't have that show without Jane, and that actor's gone a little off the rails a little. That's all.
Yeah. I don't know how they view his his behavior post post Firefly and Chuck.
Yeah. Oh yeah, Chuck. I forgot he was on Chuck.
Well, yeah, and the Firefly franchise has the same problem as Star Wars. Like R2-D2 is a part of every lore. He's always like right around the corner. And so if we don't do the main cast, then what do you even have?
Yeah, you could. I don't know. If
we should do Firefly prequels. Is that what you're saying?
Oh no. I'm saying that if they put Joss Whedon in charge, I think they could figure it out.
Oh yeah, I agree with you there.
Yeah, I trust in him. Yeah,
he wrote Cabin in the Woods in a weekend. He can pull it off.
Yeah,
yeah. They had one of the things that kicked this off is there was a reunion of the cast again at New York Comic Con, and they were all talking about how much they loved each other and how they just want to, you know, they would love another chance to make more. And it took 10 years for Star Trek the original series to go from TV show to movie. It's been more than 10 years, I guess, for Firefly, though. So
yeah, this is every single time they go to a convention, they have a similar discussion. And I think it always kind of brings this back up because it just shows the passion of the fan base. But yeah, I am sad that Firefly didn't stick around long enough for it to get the inevitable musical episode.
I want him just to come back and say Jane died heroically in some kind of thing. Zoe got remarried and time has transpired. Don't pick right up where you were.
Zoe got a job with the suits.
Right.
Mal became a private investigator and author.
Wash got a harpoonectomy.
You know what they say? You know why Wash won't eat any Reaver weapons? Because they go right through him. Anyway, moving on.
He goes for salads. Just little leaf on the wind. Polygon posted a screen cap of a tweet from Cinemark's Brazilian account that read in Portuguese that pre-orders for Star Wars The Force Awakens tickets would go on sale this coming Monday, October 19th. The tweet was deleted quickly, but Screen Crunch seems to have sources saying Disney would make an official announcement this weekend about tickets going on sale.
I didn't know Cinemark was giving Brazilians. Oh, wait, I've read the article completely wrong. I apologize. Let me back that up. So wait, what does this mean, though? It pre-orders. Oh, they're already talking like DVDs or something?
No, tickets for the movie, dude.
Oh, just for the movie. Well, it says pre-orders. That came off weird to me.
Yeah, you pre-order the ticket because you can't see it that day.
Oh, okay. Right. I get
mainly
it.
Mainly they're focusing on midnight release tickets.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right.
It's going to be madness.
All right. It's going to be so what's the order here? If it's Portuguese, we're talking about what? Brazil, okay? Right? So Brazil because of Brazilian. Are they getting it after or before us? What's the dates? Do we know?
I think the idea here is that everybody's going to have pre-orders for the movie tickets at the same time worldwide.
Oh.
No matter when the actual date of the appearance.
Did a new trailer come out today? Somebody was saying a new trailer was coming out today.
Apparently a new trailer is coming out Monday.
Oh, also. Monday. Okay, maybe I've got it wrong. I thought it was today and it was maybe a movie that was premiering tonight or something, like a Friday night something.
Coming out supposedly before Spectre.
Okay. I'm down.
Right, they're making it when Spectre is supposed to come out, even though it's my movie in the movie direct.
Yeah, come on, Tom. Support your team.
Spectre's coming out November 6th.
Oh, all right. Hey, guys. Today's episode brought to you by Casper.com. Oh, man. Have I told you how much I like my Casper.com mattress? Have I not? Well, it's amazing. I love them. They're obsessively engineered mattresses at very fair prices. I don't have to go to a showroom and lay on something or some other dude's been there. Long-lasting comfort and support. That's their mantra. Buy it easily online, completely risk-free. Just give it a shot. They'll send it to you for a 100-day period. That's 100 days. You can try it out. No showroom. And if you decide to keep it like I did, just keep it. It's fantastic. I have never slept better. You can save an additional $50 as one of our audience members by going to casper.com/currentgeek. That's casper.com/currentgeek. And then you need to use the promo code currentgeek. Today's episode is also brought to you by audible.com, where right now you can get Aftermath, Star Wars, Journey to the Stars, The Force Awakens. Ooh, let's hear a sample.
Starlines streak across the bright black.
Ooh, we got it's dramatic and has the sounds and everything, man. What else do you want? I think that's a pretty good deal right there. So do check that out. That's Aftermath, Star Wars, Journey to the Stars, The Force Awakens on Audible right now. You can get that book or any book absolutely free out of 150,000 total selection titles, choices. Go to audiblepodcast.com/currentgeek. That's audiblepodcast.com/currentgeek. Do it today. Let's do this.
America scores and wins.
All right, listen up, everybody. It's time for the pop quiz, where our guests get asked questions in areas of their expertise. Oftentimes, they get them correctly, and when they do, when they don't, Tom scores the whole thing. They compete a little bit. It's always good fun. Let's start with Jonathan. Jonathan, you ready for your topic, sir?
Is this why you asked me what my favorite movie was?
Maybe.
Oh, damn it. All right.
Jaws trivia. Jaws trivia.
Oh, God. Okay.
And we're not talking about the shark. We mean the guy with the funny teeth in the James Bond movie. No, I'm just kidding. It's the shark. It's fine. All right. Here's your first question. What year did the novel Jaws by Peter Benchley get published?
1970?
Oh, you're pretty close. 1974 is the correct answer.
Oh, so within a year it was made. Okay.
That's what's crazy. I had no idea that the book and the movie were so close to each other.
You get 0.01 point for that. Come on.
Yeah, that's pretty close. What's next here? What name did Steven Spielberg give to the shark? He named
Bruce.
It.
Oh. Bruce. He named him after his lawyer.
Wow, look at you, dude. Nice. All right. I'm impressed. All right. In Jaws 2, how does the shark get killed?
He bites a giant electric cable.
You are correct. Gets electrocuted. And how Scheider's character did not get electrocuted is beyond everyone's scope of understanding.
Magic.
In what month in 1975 did Jaws get released to theaters? Jaws 1.
It was released on June 20th, 1975. I was born 6 days later.
Oh, weird. All right. Jeez.
Triple points for that.
That's pretty good. What are the names of the dolphins in Jaws 3?
I said my favorite movie was Jaws. I know. You're asking me about Jaws 3.
I know. I'm with you.
Bonus half point for calling it Jaws 3D correctly.
I'm going to say Skippy and Flippy.
You are not that far. It's Cindy and Sandy, but close.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's weird how that kind of sounded similar. What is the name of the island beach being terrorized in the first Jaws movie?
Amity Island. Amity, as you know, means friendship.
He's cheating, Tom. He's going to get all the points. I don't mean cheating on the game. I mean,
no,
he
lost a half point showing off his full mind skills.
That's a line from the movie. Mayor Vaughn, Larry Vaughn, says to
another
the
another half point.
Another half point. Just keeps adding up.
Keep at it.
Second to last question. Yeah, you're Kyle's all for this. The role of Brody was originally offered to what actor?
Don't get Brody.
Lee Marvin.
You are incorrect. It is Robert Duvall. However, Duvall only wanted to play Quint, and they said, forget it, you're out.
Huh, okay.
Final question. What year was Jaws, the Revenge, released?
Oh, my God. Jaws 4, the Revenge with Michael Caine. I'm going to say...
Half point, Jaws 4 knowledge.
That's pretty good.
1987?
You are correct. Nicely done.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
wow.
87 is correct.
That was legit a guess.
Well, you did great. Hold on to yourself, though, because the challenge is not quite over. Kyle has his chance. It is MOBA history trivia. MOBA, that's, you know, like Dota.
I love that you were about to explain what MOBA was.
I know,
and then
to Kyle, of all people. Mr. Rank 1 in Heroes and then 15 years of MOBA experience. Here you go, Kyle. I'm laying it on you.
Yeah, I was under 10 for part of that. So
okay. What StarCraft map is considered to be the first MOBA-style map?
Aeons of Strife.
You are correct. Nicely done. What modder slash map maker created the original Defense of the Ancients map for Warcraft 3?
Ice Frog picked it up, but it was some other dude.
You are right about that. But the name is Eul. E-U-L. Yeah.
Full point. It was some other dude.
All right. He's totally right. What two names was Heroes of the Storm known as originally? There were two different names, one after the other, year after year. What were they?
Blizzard All-Stars.
Correct for one of them.
And then...
You're not being judged on order, so you're fine if you're out of order.
Oh, Blizzard Dota.
You are correct. It was originally Blizzard Dota. They then changed it to Blizzard All-Stars. It then became Heroes of the Storm. Rightly so, by the way. Neither of those were good names.
Nah.
What year was League of Legends originally released?
2007?
2009. Mm-hmm. Only a year shy of when the greatest video game of our generation came out, Red Dead Redemption. All right, next up. Just a little plug for Red Dead. What developer is behind the short-lived DC's Infinite Crisis MOBA, which I played and quite liked, by the way? I don't know what happened there. I think they saw the competition and said, we're out. We're not doing this.
oh man, it's one of those dudes who just never do their own thing.
I'll give you a hint. They were more famous in their beginnings as MMO developers, if that gives you any help.
Like Infarax or something like that?
Close, not really. It's Turbine Entertainment.
Oh,
0.01 for being close, but not really.
The Lord of the Rings guys.
Those guys. What developer created the MOBA Smite?
Oh, third person MOBA.
I know. Don't tell Jocelyn, she'll punch you.
I know. I've got
that. She loves that game.
Infotainment.
No. It was Hi-Rez Studios.
Equally as generic.
They also,
half point for being poetically correct.
Yeah. They also did the, although it's back in support now, for a while it was kind of languishing, but they did the remake of Tribes, the Tribes thing. It's really fun, by the
Tribes
way.
Tribes called Quest.
Yeah, that's the one. No? Second to last question. What month in 2014 did the Heroes of the Storm technical alpha first go live?
That would have been April.
You are incorrect. It is March of 2014.
Aw.
March. Smarch. Lousy smarch weather. All right, final question. During Heroes of the Storm alpha testing, what Diablo character was included as a pre-order bonus for Reaper of Souls?
Vala.
You are correct. Nicely done. I don't, honestly, I try, in my head, I can sometimes tell who's going to win because I kind of kept track and it was close or it was way far, but I don't know about these two. So, Tom, you're going to have to tell us how they do.
Kyle with 4.51, Jonathan Strickland with 6.01.
Wow.
Nice job, dude. Way to go. Congratulations. You don't get anything for it.
Bye. Scott, I've got breaking news.
Uh-oh, beep, 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 beep. What?
IO9 has from multiple sources that we'll get to see a one sheet from Disney on Sunday morning about ticket sales for The Force Awakens. Uh-huh. The trailer will debut Monday night around 8 p.m. Eastern time during Monday Night Football. Okay. And tickets will go on sale after that, likely around 8:30 p.m. Eastern time. Yeah. They should be available at most, if not all, ticketing sites and theaters.
Any word on whether the trailer will be online then, or is it just TV?
Does not say. I bet it would be online though once they put it on air.
Yeah, because after that it goes online whether they want it to or not.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
Right. Yeah. Quick question for you guys. Do you guys? I mean, I honestly am hoping to avoid seeing this trailer because I'm already sold. I know I'm going to go see the movie, and at this point, I want to have as many moments of discovery while I watch the film as possible. Do you guys feel similarly, or are you more along the lines of no? Just feed me as much as you can.
Man, Kyle, you answer this first. You're the youngest. What are you going to do? Not that age has anything to do with it, so I don't know why I brought it up, but what are you going to do?
This next trailer is supposed to be the one where they reveal who the actual villains are. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to check it out because I want to. They say Benicio del Toro's like hidden in there, possibly.
What?
And really? He's got like one of those Cillian Murphy, like Abraham Lincoln faces where you just can't stop looking at him.
Cillian Murphy. Abraham Lincoln face is never a thing I thought was a thing you could just apply. But I know what you're saying. Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. That's hilarious. So I didn't know about that Del Toro. Is that for sure? Is he in that? I didn't know
they
that.
Say.
Okay. All right. Tom?
Oh, you know. Yes. I'm going to watch it multiple times. I'm the guy who like just finished buying way too many comics, Star Wars, Shattered Empire, Kanan, all of them. I want to know as much as possible. I'm soaking in it.
I think that's awesome that you're doing that. So I am the same. I want to analyze it. I want to see the frame by frames. I want people to tell me where the Easter eggs are. I'm all into soaking that thing up. Now, if you're my wife, you have avoided every trailer and teaser and comment. Well, she doesn't even know the Han Solo says Chewie, we're home. She has no idea.
I'm spoiler. Scott.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm here too, man.
Have you not seen it?
No, I haven't seen it. I was going to say that the reason why I'm avoiding it, part of it is just that I am so excited about this new trilogy of films, but I also still have the very raw wounds from the prequels. And I remember how excited I was to see that first teaser trailer for The Phantom Menace, where they had the reveal of the double-bladed lightsaber there, right there in the teaser.
Yeah.
And it was one of the... I keep thinking that there's nothing that would have saved episode one for me, ever.
Yeah.
But if I had had the moment of discovery of that double-bladed lightsaber in the movie, if I had not seen that before I'd gone in, it would have been at least one of those moments where I gasp in the theater.
Yeah.
It would have gotten a reaction. And that's why I'm trying my best to prevent seeing more stuff. I want that experience of being in the theater and freaking out with other Star Wars fans when something unbelievable happens on the screen and it's not been spoiled for me in a trailer or a teaser.
Yeah, I think I admire it. Like, my wife's the same way. She's even more hardcore because she loves Star Wars and wants nothing to do with it until it comes out. She wants to be completely surprised. She successfully has done this for Age of Ultron, the new Batman versus Superman. She's seen nothing. Like, all the stuff that she loves to go see with all of us, we're all super stoked about, she has saved herself. And even in the theater, something will come up and she'll go, uh-oh, that looks like a nerd thing that we're all going to want to see. She'll put her head down and plug her ears. Like, she is hardcore into it. Now, I can't do it. I have to see it.
I got to say, I love Pixar, the way Pixar used to approach trailers, or at least the teasers, in that they would release something that was not actually in the movie. It just gave you a sense of the tone and the quality of the film. So, like, if you watched the one for Monsters, Inc., it wasn't a scene from Monsters, Inc. It was a teaser that gave you the idea of what Monsters, Inc. was all about.
Yeah.
And it's the same with...
Sorry, I thought you were done.
No, yeah, pretty much. I was just going to say Finding Nemo was the same way. But you were going to say, Tom?
I was those Mad Men trailers for every episode where they showed you absolutely nothing about the next episode.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's a rare thing. Yes, Kyle.
John, aren't you concerned about, like, gauging your expectations? Because to me, seeing that trailer with the flip and the Millennium Falcon, like, I needed to see that so I could go, okay, cool, the camera's going to shake. This is not going to be shot like an old epic.
Right. Yeah, that teaser definitely, well, I needed the teaser. And the reason I needed the teaser was I needed to be reassured that this new series was not going to be the prequels. Mm-hmm. And seeing the level of detail, seeing the practical, like, the fact that there were going to be practical effects, that this was going to be a different beast than the prequels. I needed that to reassure me. And now I'm excited about the movies, but don't need to see any more before I see the movie.
I'm telling you, we've all bought a toy based on a droid we've only seen about a half second of footage of, and we're all getting Jar Jar 2, and we just don't know it.
I was at Disney World for Force Friday, and yeah. I was holding action figures in my hand with push buttons, mm-hmm. And like, you touch the one, the stormtrooper, you'd be like, get him, and like, go to C block. And you're like, is C block a place I'm going to know about? Is this like the best place ever? Or am I listening to Jar Jar?
Yeah, you never know. Yeah.
Misa's so hot in there.
But yeah, I mean, that when the prequel toys came out, you know, they had the ones that were on the stand and they each had a chip on them inside the toy. And you put them on the stand, you press the button and it would play lines from the movies. And this was before the movies had come out. And I don't even want that experience. I do have a BB-8. You're right. I do own a BB-8. But
we're putting a lot of faith in that thing, yeah. and we've not seen anything other than it bouncing around on the desert for a second and peeking around a corner. We don't know, man.
We've also seen it chase my dog.
Yeah, and that's pretty good, right?
My dog won't go in the living room right now because of it.
What if it's just, what if it's purely, like, it's fine visually, story-wise, it's fine, but it makes sounds like it just goes beep, boop, beep. Like, that just does that the whole time, like Lewis Black doing a droid.
Well, but the toy doesn't do that.
Oh, that's true. You guys have heard that too. All right. I'm not trying to set it up for failure. I just want us to check our expectations. I am personally very stoked, and I wish I had a BB-8 also. All right. Moving on. By the way, today's episode brought to you by Citadel 32 by Tom Merritt. Tom, tell us what that's about. What is that?
Well, based on the moon, a man finds a strange discovery that could lead to reconnection with Earth, but someone wants to stop him. Meanwhile, on Earth, a monk of the Citadel discovers a strange ancient artwork. Could it lead to the truth of the myth of the moon men? Find out.
I'm just kidding.
I love that. Actually, that was pretty awesome.
The whole time you were doing that, I was trying to find some appropriate, like, cool music, and I couldn't find any, so...
Citadel 32, TomMerrittBooks.com. Thank you very much.
Yeah, do check that out. What else? Oh, let's get to this. We got some time for this. Here you go.
The future promises even more startling things to come.
It's forecast. We predict the future, and we decide what the nerd future looks like, either technology or entertainment or whatever it may be. And I put today's in because I'm a big believer in this. So my good friend and fellow podcaster and fellow co-host, Brian Ibbett, got a new 3D printer yesterday, and he's super jazzed about it, and he's making cool stuff, and it has a big print volume, so you can make bigger things, and It's all very cool. And watching that market grow and evolve and the whole Maker thing kind of take off and the MakerBots and other devices, and then seeing them beginning refined and iterated on, I think that that means in the next 10 years, we are going to have 3D printers or fabricators of some sort that are large enough for us to build kitchen items like blenders, replacement parts for our washers, new sink fixtures, that kind of thing. It will build our clothes or make our clothes. It will make shoes. It will make all that kind of stuff. And at some point, you'll be able to make, like, I don't know, a toaster oven. What this is all going to mean is stores and places, entities like Walmart are going to struggle mightily and have to do all kinds of new things to survive. Thoughts, feelings. Am I wrong? Am I right?
Walmart will be fine. Okay. Because Walmart is like a weird, strange, odd entity. It won't really have anything to do with it. It'd be changed. I think you're absolutely right about that. Bed Bath & Beyond, the Container Store, places
IKEA.
Like that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, anything that is made up of walls and walls of plastic doodads hanging, I think those are the ones in danger.
Yeah, that's a good point. I hadn't thought about those. Yes, John.
Yeah, IKEA definitely would be. And this is where we get into the world where the physical object becomes intellectual property, where we have to figure out, do we create a new type of protection for physical objects to protect that kind of idea so that someone doesn't just go into a store, take a picture of an existing product, go home with computer-aided design, create a 3D model of that product, and then print their own. Also, I mean, you're talking about within 10 years. I go back and forth on this because I think that we're going to see, at least between now and then, we're going to see a lot of small businesses doing printing on demand for people. But once we get to a point where you've got a 3D printer sophisticated enough and versatile enough to be able to print all the things you need for another 3D printer, it's game over. Because if you can print your own 3D printer with something, your buddy, you and a bunch of friends get in together, you buy a 3D printer, you print all the parts you need for another 3D printer, you put that together, you give it to one of your friends, both of you print another 3D printer, and then it just spreads. And there are actually open source projects that are specifically dedicated to trying to make this happen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So once you get there, that's it.
Yep.
You'll always have goo. You know, you got to buy the goo somewhere to make the prints. And I mean, I love, you know, I got a big old brother's printer. I love the conk and the big old thing and load it up in there. It feels great. But then you have your tiny little like HP printers that they give away whenever you buy a laptop because it's practically a subscription fee.
Right.
Like $32 a month.
Well, Kyle, I don't want to spoil this, but I think there actually is a real reason why the company was named Google.
So that's where we'll get it all.
Delivered to your door by Google Express.
Oh, that's terrible.
I think maybe you nailed it. Walmart will be selling goo and probably renting out printing to people who can't afford to buy their own 3D printers.
Yeah, you're probably right. If they adjust, I guess what I'm saying is you just don't want that Blockbuster problem to happen. Or, you know, I heard this NPR Planet Money thing about spreadsheets. And when the first Lotus 1-2-3 functioning spreadsheet came to light, that entire industry panicked. They freaked out because CPAs everywhere are like, oh my gosh, you've reduced my office of 15 clerks and CPAs to one guy and a computer in overnight. Like the business disruption potential of printing physical objects in a world where most of it's manufactured for us is a pretty groundbreaking, crazy thing. It's maybe not on the level of, you know, cold fusion for your car, but it's right up there, man.
It's right up there with Industrial Revolution, I would argue. I mean, you're talking about first of all, let's think about what some of the implications are between now and 10 years when we reach this point where we all have one of these things in our own homes.
Yeah.
Even before then, when we get to a point where you can make stuff that is of a similar quality as the stuff that we manufacture in traditional methods, once you get to that point and you can print on demand, inventory is no longer an issue, right? Mm-hmm. You don't print more than you need. You print when you need it.
Yeah.
So now you don't need warehouses. Warehouses are a thing of the past.
And presumably you don't have the limits of like, this takes 36 hours to print. In 10 years, hopefully we're ripping things
faster,
out quickly.
Right.
Yeah. So there's all those sorts of factors that kick in and change everything. I mean, yeah, I didn't even consider what Tom was saying. Like IKEA, Container Store. Like, those guys are screwed. There's no way that that stuff, you know, thrives under all of this. But then maybe they'll pull a GameStop and figure out how to stay really relevant in an ever-changing industry.
Or like, a Best Buy, right? There's always we always think of the ones like the Circuit Cities of the world that went away, or the Borders books. Right. But there's always a few that figure out like what their niche is and how to stay relevant.
Yeah. Well, the hard part is, I mean, can they keep up at that point? Because if you've got, you know, like Mayflies or something last a day and they regenerate, they're evolving faster than other creatures. So if everyone at home can invent everything themselves, you would expect technology to just go wicked fast.
Bed Bath & Beyond is going to become a big patent organization, essentially.
Because
you think software patents are bad? The patent wars that this will cause are going to be huge.
Oh, I hadn't even seen that. That's a whole other thing, right? Because there's patents on all kinds of like bread boxes and toaster shapes and like, oh my gosh, Tom, I hadn't even considered that.
Think of it like this, like here's holy what I would shit. Do. Yeah. If I were looking ahead and I saw the writing on the wall and I was head of one of these big companies that would be in danger, the thing I would think of is, how can I transition so that I'm no longer selling physical goods? I'm selling plans for the stuff for people to print.
Yeah.
So in other words, I create the files that you go online and you think, I need a new chair, and you go online, you look through all these different virtual chairs in a catalog and say, this is the one I want. You purchase the file for a low amount, and then you print it at home. Then you become a totally different business, but based on the same thing that, you know, you were built around.
Yeah, I like this theory because it's a lot like I've said with movies. We all have equipment now and software and ways to be filmmakers. All of us could make a movie right now. We could hang up from this call, and all of us very cheaply could make a 2-hour movie in a couple of weeks' time if we wanted to. But nobody wants to watch that because there's money involved in fidelity and quality and all that, but also there's acting and writing and things that we're just not all going to do ourselves. So if I had twins, I may want to get a bunk bed 3D printed for them rather than going and getting something at a store, but I may not know what's the best way to make them look like, you know, cars or race cars or something cool or whatever. I want that to come to me through some other source. That's why I think that even like spreadsheets, when they took over, yes, lots of CPAs lost their jobs or people who helped CPAs, but countless new jobs were created to support the new infrastructure that meant this sort of, you know, new digital and at the time printed out, but, you know, eventually digital future we were all heading to, and having a computer crunch the numbers. And so I think it's the same thing. New jobs will get created. They're not the ones we expect or even maybe want, but I agree with you. They're going to want the designs, or they're going to want the, like Tom says, they're going to want to be able to get the licensed thing. Although, oh, the piracy. Dude, we're talking about physical goods.
We'll sell you a one-time-use chair design, Scott, but it's not meant for reprinting for resale.
Oh, my gosh. Think of that.
Well, there's going to be some serious DRM.
Yeah, and what
or
about
Captain
like...
Kipper called it 3DRM.
3DRM, yes. That's a great idea. And when you print that chair out, it'll come out with a big knot, like a big stick in the middle, and there's no way you're sitting on that because it's a DR, it's protective.
Yeah.
That's great.
You can call and get that knot unlocked and then take it off.
You know, again, there's a comic in this, and I'll have to think about that later. Good stuff. I love Forecast. If you have your own recommendations for Forecast, you can send those in to currentgeek@gmail.com. And that is going to do it for today's show. Huge thanks to our guest, Kyle. Let's start with you. I'd like to hear where people can find more Kyle Ferguson on the internet.
You can find me at Twitter, at Kyle Ferguson. You can find me at KyleFerguson.com. There you can find my Heroes Coaching. I do videos as well as private lessons, so check that out. And Into the Nexus, Thursdays, 5 p.m. Pacific on amove.tv.
With Garrett Weinzerl. Excellent. John, what's going on? What do you got there?
You can find me at howstuffworks.com. You can follow me on Twitter at John Strickland. I do a couple of other podcasts. I do Podcasts Without Pretense, which is a super goofy show with Ayaz Akhtar and Eric Sandine. You can join our literal dozens of viewers, and we do that nearly every Wednesday. But you could also subscribe to my show Tech Stuff. That's the one that's been going on for almost 8 years. I got more than 700 episodes of that, so check that out, because if you like the kind of tech talk we just had, I do that all the time.
Man, congrats on that, though. That's great, that number. 700 plus episodes. That's amazing. Not too many people can say that about their shows. I can only say it about one show I do, and that's because I do it 4 days a week. Anyway, Tom Merritt, anything else?
Yeah, I'm the host of East Meets West with Roger Chang. It's subbrilliant.com/EMW.
I love that show. Is there a new episode coming up?
Yeah, our 10-year anniversary episode this month.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Wow.
I love listening to that. I'm a big Roger Tom combination fan.
We don't even have 700 episodes.
All right. I think that's going to do it for us. Thank you all for being here. Fantastic episode. Andrew Allen does our theme music. You guys have heard it before. It's fantastic. I know you love it. I do. Call us. Leave us a voicemail. 801-471-0462. At Current Geek on Twitter. At Scott Johnson. At Ace Detect. CurrentGeek.reddit.com. For everything else, CurrentGeek.com. It's going to do it for us, for me, for Tom, and our guests. We'll see you next time.
Hi, and welcome back to Legal Geek. This week, we take a look at how DC Comics is continuing to defend the long-standing trademarks in Krypton and Kryptonite against the forces of evil, aka trademark dilution. Superman started as a comic book in 1938, but further trademarks were developed in 1943 for Krypton and Kryptonite. Krypton is a real element on the periodic chart, as well as Superman's home planet, but that has not stopped DC Comics from continuing to actively use this mark and establish continued rights of that trademark. As we've covered before on this segment, part of properly maintaining trademark rights is stopping others from cutting in on the mark and diluting it. Just this month, DC Comics has actively engaged in legal disputes with two potential competitors using Krypton or Kryptonite marks. In October 2014, Ravensmood Productions filed a trademark application to register the Kryptonite vapor mark and logo that the company uses with electronic cigarette refill cartridges. Many times, the application for a trademark is precisely what causes the original trademark owner to more vigorously defend their own rights, and that's what happened here. DC Comics filed an opposition in the U.S. Trademark Office against the allowance of Ravensmoon's application, and it looks like Ravensmoon has no interest in a fight with the Man of Steel. They've announced on their website that the product formerly known as Kryptonite Vapor will now be sold as Ravensmoon Vapor. So fear not, citizens of Metropolis, your teenagers won't be confused about whether their favorite vaping cartridges are officially licensed by DC Comics. A much bigger company is also now at odds with the Superman IP. Just this week, DC Comics filed an extension of time to oppose Chevrolet's own trademark applications for Krypton and Camaro Krypton in a class that covers automobiles. Unlike some other DC superheroes like Batman and his Batmobile, there's not an immediate, obvious tie between Superman and automobiles. It'll be fascinating to see what this project is, if it ever sees the light of day, and whether these two mega companies are willing to make a deal over this famous Superman IP. The bottom line is, we can learn a lot by watching creative companies like DC Comics defend trademarks like the Superman IP, and one of the life lessons learned is to avoid filing trademark applications that compete unless you are ready to fight that legal battle. Until next time, don't go leaping buildings in a single bound without requesting a license from DC Comics first.
Thanks for listening. Please provide feedback and legal-themed questions or segment suggestions to me on Twitter at BuckeyeFitzy.
This show is part of the Frog Pants Network. Get more at frogpants.com.